Happy Saturday. It's March 16th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And we are two of your airmail editors that are here to bring you an antidote from all the news that's happening in the world. Quickly to recap, in the U.S., Biden and Trump have secured their respective nominations, and the country is gearing up for a bitter, contentious, and certainly in some part absurd contest for the presidency. In Russia, a top aide to Alexei Navalny was beaten with a hammer and doused with tear gas as he pulled up to his house in Vilnius. And in the UK, poor Princess Catherine can't seem to catch a break after a minor Photoshop scandal is just the latest setback, making the monarchy look weaker and more imperiled than ever. Oh no. However, Michael, being different is our raison d'etre. And on that note, our new issue is full of delicious distractions.
Yes, and you can have a safe and sane haven from the world because we have a great show for you today. Andrew Rifkin will share his insights on what the election in Russia means for Vladimir Putin and the rest of the world. Then, the wonderful Pico Iyer will join us from Tokyo to discuss what you might call the deformative years, memories of his days at English boarding school, in a new book by Princess Diana's brother that looks at that culture. And finally, there is a new film out that chronicles Paul Simon's road from teenage crooner from Forest Hills, Queens, New York, to global chart topper and beyond. And the director, the acclaimed documentarian Alex Gibney, will join us to discuss the making of this poignant film. Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Let's start with Andrew Rifkin. Andrew Rifkin is a screenwriter, journalist, and Russian affairs specialist.
Hi, Ashley. Hi, Michael.
So, Andrew, it's an election moment in Russia, although not many people would know it, given how it hasn't been covered by the press. But tell us exactly what's going on.
Well, this podcast comes out on Saturday, so today is the second day of the 2024 presidential election in Russia. It's a three-day process, mostly designed, it's 3 days because it's mostly designed to sort of enable fraudulent voting and things like that, and kind of it's made to ensure Putin's win, just like everything else, pretty much. So this election hasn't been covered too much, not just in the Western media, where I'm guessing everyone kind of knows that the candidate that's going to win, but also in the Russian media. Russian media is downplaying this election. It doesn't get a lot of coverage, even on propaganda channels. And many political observers, like I noted in the article, they say that this election is by far the emptiest one. It lacks essence or content, and it's mostly made to rely on voter turnout, with these voters being state employees or those who get their salaries from the budget, or those working in corporations linked to the state, like the ones that produce armaments and things as such. And in that, this election is a very pro forma process. So no surprise that many people haven't heard a thing about it.
So, Andrew, in the Putin handbook for rigging an election, what are some of the key tenets?
The thing is, I doubt this election, it's definitely going to be rigged. But at this point, it's not about the number of votes that Putin's going to get. It's the turnout. Now, today is Saturday. So we don't yet know the results of the election. Is Putin going to get 93% of the votes, 79, maybe 104? We don't know that because over the years, Kremlin came up with a concept that they really need for people to come to the voting booths. And the numbers that Putin is going to get, that's all going to be fixed in post. And essentially, they do have a lot of these quirky processes to get the people to vote. For instance, state employees are mandated, basically, unofficially, but still, to bring with them their entire family who are of voting age. So they would also vote. A number of state company employees, like such as those that make weapons and things, they have a very interesting system there. They're given QR codes at their workplace. It's a unique QR code that identifies them. So they have to go to vote. They go and vote. And when they exit the polling station, they're met with exit pollsters. Now, in Russia, exit pollsters aren't the kind of people who ask you, oh, who did you vote for? So they could tally up the vote and analyze it, like preliminary results. No, these exit pollsters, they scan your QR code, like a hall pass, basically, at a school, so that you can prove your attendance, so that you can prove that you voted. But again, the votes themselves, that's decided in the Kremlin. From what I understand, they're trying to strike a balance between a show of national unity and Pyongyang-level dictatorship. So the numbers, the real number is kind of floating between, not the real one, the one that Kremlin's aiming for, it's between about 79 and 84%. They feel like it's the optimal number to show that, yes, about one-fifth of the Russian electorate, of the Russian public, is against Putin. And relatively, that number does seem realistic. But everyone else, the 80%, they're definitely for Putin, for the war, and for this neo-fascist course that the country's on.
Number one, I find it humorous that, like, it takes three official days to get out the vote to make sure everything's elected. But you make an interesting point that Putin's slogan this year is Russia, period, Putin, period, 2024. But I'm curious, as you note, this election, it's important, I guess, for us in the West to remember, this is not about projecting an image of Putin as a legitimate ruler to a wider audience. Why is this election happening? What is the real reason behind it?
Michael, you're getting right at the core of this article. The reason behind this election, like you rightfully said, it's not about projecting legitimacy, because at this point, March 2024, Putin is a wanted criminal. Putin can't visit most countries on earth. He would be arrested for kidnapping Ukrainian children. And I'm sure more criminal cases are going to be brought against him for the atrocities committed in Ukraine. So the public rhetoric that you hear from Western leaders, there's no doubt that they don't believe the results of this election. There's no doubt that they don't consider him, at least unofficially, but they don't consider him a legitimate ruler of Russia. Moreover, even for Russians, there's really no doubt about the outcome of this election, and they have no illusions about this election being a truly democratic process, or even a process that would sort of reaffirm popular support for Vladimir Putin. This entire election, this entire multi-million dollar enterprise, the bureaucratic procedure, actually Putin's spokesperson called it. He said that our election is not democracy. It's simply a very expensive bureaucratic procedure. And he's right. This entire thing is designed for one man and one man only. It's for Vladimir Putin to sit back in his Italian leather armchair or whatever and to just look at the results. Because as one of my sources told me, he loves seeing people vote for him. He loves these numbers. The rest of this election, it's essentially carried out by the Kremlin to give him this feeling, to give him basically ability to turn on the TV and see a pretty little number, high number actually, of the people who vote for him. It's a one-man show for a one-man audience.
I was just going to say, I mean, so essentially keeping up this farce is really nothing more than an act of ego on Putin's part. But how do you see regular Russians participating or not participating as acts of protest, whether it's silent or not so silent?
In terms of protest and protesting this election, Alexei Navalny, Russia's leading opposition figure who died in an Arctic prison just, I want to say, like nearly a month ago. Yes. So basically his last instruction for the Russian opposition was that they carry out this political action. So they all gather on this Sunday. They gather at exactly 12 p.m. at noon at the polling stations, and it's called Noon Against Putin. And they vote for any candidate except for Putin. So this is kind of like opposition voting, even though there are no real candidates. The ones that are there, their ratings are between 1 and maybe 3%, because the Kremlin at this point considers any politician with a rating above 5% risky for Putin. So they only pick the ones that definitely have no chance, not just against Putin, but no chance for popular support. And this, so far, action that they're, I can't even call it rally, really, this action, the Noon Against Putin, is pretty much the only thing that the opposition can do at this point. And it's designed much more as a show of solidarity and support, just so people who live in this near totalitarian state, so that they can see that they're not alone. This is basically it. There's no way that they can subvert these elections. There's no way that they can make them seem illegitimate or take a bite out of Putin's 80, 90, 110% vote. At this point, the Russian opposition, all they can do is just see that they're not alone. Besides that, and that's, I'm talking about the peaceful opposition to Putin. But when it comes to opposition, it's not just peaceful. There are these groups, nationalist, anti-Putin groups, military groups, militias, basically, fighting in Ukraine on the Ukrainian side against Russians. They recently, just this week, they made a number of incursions into Russia proper from Ukraine. And these are the people who are saying, basically, that don't do these vote for anyone but Putin. Your victory is not at the polling booth. It's at the warm end of a gun. And that to fight Putin, you need to fight him with strength, with force, with the only language that Putin understands. So this election is a really good signifier as to just how destroyed the peaceful Russian opposition is and how the militias that popped up since the war in Ukraine started, how they're slowly taking the initiative from those who used to think that they can play by the rules.
I was going to say, I mean, I wish I could say we'd be watching this election with bated breath, Andrew, but indeed, it turns out it's somewhat of a nothing burger, no?
It is. It's an affirmation for one man. Even the slogan, this Russia Putin 2024, it's basically reminiscent of Louis XIV, the Sun King, when he said, I am the state. This is Putin proving to himself that he is the state. So we already know that he thinks that this is just an exercise in solipsism. So in that sense, these elections are really nothing interesting, pretty much just sad, but at times funny.
He just reminds me of some sort of Bill Murray moment, like, what? A surprise party for me? Get out of here. The election tally's coming in. Sir, we know there was an election today. Oh my God, I won.
That's exactly it. They love me even more than before. In fact, from what I know, the Russian presidential administration, now they have these KPIs, key performance indicators for the voter turnout, the number of votes, et cetera, et cetera. And they set them way before Putin even announces that he's running. Putin loves a bit of a mystery. Like, is he going to run? Is he not going to run? And he has the entire country, the entire world guessing, I'm putting air quotes here, as to whether he's actually going to be running for president, which of course he is. But these performance indicators set by the Kremlin last summer, when they first started talking about this election, they did say that they are looking for Putin to receive more votes, higher percentage of the votes than ever before. So you can say that his appetites for surprise parties, Putin's appetites, they're growing.
Well, Andrew, it's a great story, and we love your take on it. Thank you so much for giving us some insight into this very weird, wicked world.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Andrew. You're great.
See you soon. Okay, Michael, once again, very happy that I don't live in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, we can only hope and see where the election goes. But on a sort of slightly similar note about strange days and strange ways to live, I want to get Pico Iyer on here to talk about this new book by Princess Diana's brother, Charles Spencer. He has written a new book called A Very Private School, in which he details his brutal tenure as a young boy at a British boarding school rife with sexual and emotional abuse. And Pico has reviewed it for us this week.
And Pico, of course, is a marvelous, marvelous writer. He's been based in Japan for many years. He's the author of, among other things, A Beginner's Guide to Japan, Autumn Lights, and The Lady and the Monk, one of my favorite writers, and a columnist for Airmail. Welcome, Pico Iyer. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We loved your review of Charles Spencer's book. We're so happy to have you here to talk about it.
Yes.
You have intimate experience with these boarding schools that Spencer writes about. So why don't you take us back and tell us a little bit about your experience?
So the school I went to from the age of 9 to 13, a boarding school, was fairly different in circumstances from his. His was an exclusive school of 75 in Northamptonshire. Mine was a school of 500 in Oxford. Reading his book, it was uncanny. Every detail about the meals, the bars, crazy rituals, the strange terms, identical. And then after that, I went to the same high school that he did, and I went to the same college as Oxford that he did 7 years before he went there. So it's really an assembly line that so many have been going through for hundreds of years, and he got every detail spot on, I must say.
And when you say you went to the same high school, we're talking about Eton?
We are, yes. And it must be said, and this is an important distinction, that he has nothing to say about or against Eton in this book. The whole book is aimed at Maidwell Hall, which is the school he went to from the age of 8 to 13. And as he points out, that's an important distinction because we've all had plenty of the English public school madness of 14, 15-year-old boys thrashing their way through adolescence. This is about defenseless little boys of 8 and 11. So whatever happens to them is much harder to justify.
And how did Spencer write about that time in his life? I mean, there have been a lot of headlines in the UK about the allegations of sexual misconduct that he experienced. But it seems like, at least from your review, it was a bit more of a mixed bag for him.
Well, it's a tremendously angry book. And he claims to have been scarred for life. And he talks to many of his contemporaries who say their lives have been destroyed by that experience. The big surprise, which probably people know already, is that the sexual abuse came at the hands of a woman of 19 or 20 years old, who was an assistant matron, as they call it, who suddenly realized she had all these 11-year-old boys, as it were, at her beck and call. And that took me by surprise. We're familiar with the stories of sadistic teachers taking their delights from hitting little boys, but this was utterly unexpected. I think the thing that should be stressed is, for me, is that Spencer was very vulnerable from the beginning. His mother ran away from the family when he was 2. He was the youngest of 4 kids. His dad was completely bewildered when his wife left. So even when he was 4 or 5, in this book, everything that comes out is really sadness and complaint. And even before he arrived at this school, Maidwell Hall, he was suffering through terrible nightmares. And I remember when we first began learning Latin at the age of 6 or 7, one of the first phrases we learned was post hoc non est propter hoc. In other words, B happens after A, but that doesn't mean that B is a result of A. And so Spencer writes about how he's had 2 divorces, very sadly. He suffers from migraines. He still has nightmares. I'm not sure it's absolutely 100% certain that those are the result of what he went through at that school. It's funny, just by chance, 2 days ago, I was talking to an old friend of mine who also went to Eton and actually was in the same house as Charlie Althorp, as he was known then, Charles Spencer. And my friend was saying, I asked him, did you have a good time at school? And he said, no, I was really depressed. But I think I might have been depressed had I not gone to that school. And I think poor Spencer might have felt sad and neglected, even in other circumstances. And I think there's a touching moment when he says to the one teacher that he likes, oh, I wish I'd been to a day school. And the man says, day school's no better. And in some ways, it might be a lot worse. So there are moments where you see that things could lie in another direction, but it's almost like a prosecutor's argument. And I think because Charles Spencer had been through decades of therapy and has been encouraged to remember all that he suffered at the hands of that school, he's really anxious to take it down in a way.
Pika, what was the argument among the parents of these upper-class young boys for sending them away at such a tender age?
Well, he comes down very, very hard on his parents. And I think it's the classic upper-class English complaint we've heard for centuries, with good reason, that the parents are very distant and cold. They outsource the care of their children to nannies, and then they send them off to these barbaric schools so that they can go and have their own adventures. I think Prince Charles, in his way, might well have felt the same thing. And so they have no real justification, though I would say that those schools are very good training for a world that's never going to be soft or indulgent. So I'm one of those people who's very glad to have been through those schools. And I think I learned resilience there, independence, confidence. And for example, in my case, I was an only child with 2 very indulgent parents. And so I was well on the way to being an unbearable spoiled brat until my schools shook that out of me. I think Spencer was coming from very different circumstances, already wounded, lost, lonely, and everything he suffered could only have made that worse.
Pika, let's talk about the friendship. When you're a young boy of that age and you do have to sort of develop an entirely new community, kind of a new family structure at these schools, and especially at the time that Spencer was there and presumably you were there as well, you would go long stretches without seeing parents, right? They didn't have weekly boarding or Exie Out weekend all the time. Tell us about sort of those bonds that were formed and how that was influential, not only in Spencer's life, as he writes about, but also in yours.
Perfect question. And I think boarding school is essentially like the Marine Corps. The one difference is you don't volunteer. You're enlisted. You're sent there whether you want to or not. But the result is that you form these incredibly strong friendships for life, as people do when they're serving the same regiment in a war, whether it's Afghanistan or World War I. And I think the one lyrical phrase in the whole book is when Spencer does say that the friendships forged at his school are its golden legacy, as he puts it. And I'm almost embarrassed. So I left those schools 50 years ago. And sometimes 30, 40% of the emails I get every day are from people I was at school with when I was 8 or 12 or 14. I mean, these are really strong connections, similar to having a brother, but maybe without some of the pressures of having a brother. You're absolutely right. He stresses that in his school, at the age of 8, he was really only allowed to see his parents twice in a term, if that. Once his grandfather suddenly shows up and gives him 4 books, but they're 4 books of military history. So yes, basically his parents were out of the picture entirely. But you get the strong sense in the book that he has friends for 50 years now from Maidwell Hall. That's the one consolation. And he does concede in one of the more balanced moments that he got an excellent academic education. And that's one of the things that I think has to be put on the parents' side. When you asked why do they send their kids to these schools, arguably, they're getting a training in all the intangibles, being prepared for the world, and they're getting one of the best academic trainings. George Orwell wrote a famous essay about his elementary school and all the horrors he suffered there. He became George Orwell. And maybe he wouldn't have had he not gone through that. So, and I feel that with Spencer, I mean, it must be said, I was taken aback what a good writer he is. He's economical, he's incredibly vivid, every one of the details is salient. I mean, he mentions in passing at one point, his father, 8th Earl Spencer, was president of the National Boys Association at the same time as his own son, his only son, was going through all these torments at the school. He portrays his father sympathetically as this gentle, lost man, but ultimately he lays a lot of the blame at his parents' door.
Pico, I never went to boarding school, but I don't want to be in an all or nothing kind of response to what Spencer has written here, but do you think there are, in the 21st century, these schools have a place in England? And if so, are there any changes you would make in them?
So again, he's very good about stressing that these schools already have changed very dramatically in the last 50 years. His old school is coeducational now. The corporal punishment that was so common in his time and my time would be frowned upon. They've got much, much softer. And I believe he sends his own kids to weekly boarding schools. So they're away in the week and they come back in the weekends, and that's quite a good balance. I've always been a bit of a supporter of boarding school. And one reason is that instead of thrashing out all my adolescent problems with my parents, I was in the hands of teachers who had only one skill in life, and that was house training adolescent boys. And parents, by definition, are inexperienced. They've never raised a kid before. A school like Eton for 550 years has been devoted to one thing only, which is how do we handle a 15-year-old boy, and has presumably come up with some fairly good techniques. So I was much happier to go through adolescence at a boarding school than if I were at home. And it made my relationship with my parents, I think, much better than it would have been otherwise. They were never the target of my resentment or revolution. Rather, I was so glad to see them and released from the Spartan rigors of my school. But again, that applies to when you're 15. When you're 8 or 9, and for example, in my case, I was suddenly 6,000 miles away from my parents, it's tough, and it's a real baptism by fire. And I think maybe Spencer would suggest that boarding schools of a qualified way where kids go away 5 days of the week once they're 13 is acceptable. Before that, it's much harder.
It's a wonderful book. Obviously, these places did turn out an incredible writer in Charles Spencer and an incredible writer in you. So thank you so much for joining us to speak about this. It's always wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Always a real delight to see you.
Thank you, Pico. You take care.
Bye, Pico. Michael, I just want to talk to Pico all day. He was truly like my guide through Japan. He was in my head the entire time when I was traveling there.
Couldn't have a better guide.
Okay, moving on. Speaking of guides, taking us through the world of filmmaking, Alex Gibney.
Yeah, Alex Gibney's got a great new documentary out about Paul Simon. Ashley, I'm sure you're a big Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel fan, and this movie is not to be missed.
Let's get him on here to talk about it. Alex Gibney is a filmmaker and documentarian who's won many awards, including the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature for 2007's Taxi to the Dark Side. We also love him for Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and Going Clear, Scientology in the Prison of Belief. Welcome, Alex Gibney.
Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I'm super excited to talk to you. We all are. This documentary, of course, I'm a big Simon and Garfunkel fan, but this is on Paul Simon, extremely poignant documentary. How did this come to be, and how did you come to direct it?
Interestingly enough, Paul actually reached out to me about the possibility of doing some kind of a documentary about his music. He had seen my film on Frank Sinatra, which he liked a lot. Then we met in a small back room of a restaurant in Austin, Texas. This would have been way back, even pre-pandemic, and talked about it. Despite the fact that I was wearing a Boston Red Sox, we got on, and I was fascinated to hear him talk about his music making, which I didn't know enough about. Of course, I'd heard everything he had ever done. And then as we were talking more and more over a long period of time, at some point he said, I'm making a new album. Would you like to come down and watch me make it? That unlocked everything. Of course, he had me at I'm making a new album, but it was the ability to watch Paul work, man at work, that sort of unlocked the possibilities of the film.
I mean, and you're catching him at a very unique time in his career. He had sort of essentially retired, but literally had a calling to come back to his music, right?
He had a dream. And in the dream, he was told there is an album, Seven Psalms. The word Seven Psalms kept coming up. It's interesting. There's a kind of an anagram in there, if you think about it. P.S., Paul Simon, Alms, or Psalms is close to songs. Anyway, he wrote it down, Seven Psalms. And over time, other things began to come to him. And so he came out of retirement to make this new record, which is a meditation on both spirituality and mortality in a very poignant and sort of softly stated way. I mean, it's a very meditative album, I think you'd almost have to say, but deeply moving.
It's deeply moving, as you capture in the film, I think, because he's struggling as an artist to control his body in a way and to make the music, right?
Yeah, I think that part of the, I mean, for a film about mortality, he's struggling with the way his body is beginning to fail him. And one of the ways it's beginning to fail him is he's beginning to lose hearing in one of his ears. And for a musician, particularly a musician and a songwriter, Paul's stature, that's a real handicap. And he's having to work through that. Same time, also, the muscles in his arms can't do the things that he had once done. And he prided himself on being quite an athletic character. I mean, one of the first things I did when I got down to Wimberley, Texas, which is where he has studios, to play catch with Paul. So there was a kind of poignant sense of struggle and tribulation that as he was making the album, he felt he needed to integrate into the album itself. And as a dramatist or as a documentarian, that was hugely interesting to me, the struggle to be able to try to create at the level at which he's used to, even as some of his greatest assets are failing.
It's a great point, because when you read about and you know about Simon, he's pushed himself with each album to progress and to sort of push himself and to learn different genres of music and other elements. So were you a huge Simon fan coming into this, or you sort of rate yourself as an average guy?
No, I mean, I was a big fan of both Simon and Garfunkel and also Paul Simon. But I wouldn't say I had immersed myself in the background, particularly of the way he wrote his songs. And that to me was the interesting part and the virtue of exploring this. It was the process. And in the process of watching him create or work through the creation and trying to find the sounds he was looking for, because he's kind of a musical explorer. That was what was interesting to me. You could relate that back to previous attempts to explore, and also how he grew over time as a musician, as a songwriter. But I think one of the most interesting things about it, he was constantly looking or listening for the edge of what he thought the sound he was looking for might be. And so the whole film is a series of explorations as he's working through both his relationship with Garfunkel, but then also what was to follow that. And he begins to then geographically explore. I mean, in a way, it starts as a very young man when he goes to England, which he sees as kind of the most magical moment in his life. That was a period I didn't know much about. Simon and Garfunkel had broken up. Their first album had been a failure. He goes to kind of find himself, and he's playing in these small clubs or top of pubs in England. And then miraculously, we tell the story in the film, there was a Tom Wilson remixed Sound of Silence, and suddenly it became a huge hit. He came back. But then after Bridge Over Troubled Water, he began to explore other sounds, whether it be a ska and reggae in Jamaica for Mother and Child Reunion, and then onward, flash forward to going to South Africa for Graceland, and then also following the drums from West Africa to Brazil, where he makes Rhythm of the Saints. He's looking and listening for sounds that intrigue him, and then trying to find a way of collaborating with musicians in a way that makes something powerful and unique. So it's that exploration that I found so engaging.
Well, it's not just engaging, it's riveting, because through your lens and through what you've gotten access to, you're seeing an artist create. It's like Picasso in his studio.
It's like watching Picasso paint. That was the excitement for me. I was getting a front row seat to somebody, one of the greatest songwriters ever, making music.
And that's what's so inspiring, because he relishes the audience. Some artists are so hermetic in how they create, and he seemed to feed off the energy of having you guys there.
Well, I think that's true. I also think that he felt bad that he didn't document this kind of creative process earlier in his career. I mean, we did find some film, which was locked in his archive, of some of the studio work that he was doing with Art Garfunkel and Roy Haley on Bridge Over Troubled Water. And so there was a little bit of that, which we then exposed for the first time in this film. But he felt he had never really properly let somebody in on the process. He's a private person. And so this was an opportunity to do that, which I feel like I took full advantage of. But it's also true that when we showed up, and Kyle, the co-producer of the album, would tell you that as a performer, when we showed up with the camera, Paul kind of brought it.
I promise it will energize anyone who watches it, because despite what you're saying, that you see these physical struggles, but it is so beautiful and inspiring. And you see this guy who haunts our minds and lives in our hearts. And so many lines that just come back to you all the time. And a moment when he says, like, well, I never had the, could never sort of match Dylan in some way. I've always seen him, and he occupies a space between the Beatles and Dylan in terms of like the poetry of the three of them, right? And the music and the orchestration versus the American music. But that's just my feeling on it. But
no, I agree with you. I think he's right up there in that rare pantheon, because he's a poet of extraordinary ability, but also his understanding of the music and the rhythm of the music and also the arrangements and how sounds move.
This film is so inspiring, and it's going to just make you go down the Paul Simon rabbit hole, because whatever you quote unquote left out doesn't matter, because it's going to keep driving you back to dig in deeper and deeper. And it's such an inspiring film.
And explore. Explore his catalog. I mean, I agree 100%. I didn't want the film to be a Wikipedia entry. The purpose wasn't to say, remember this song and this song and this song. There's a story in there, and it's a story of struggle, and it's a story of aspirations, story of spiritual yearning and mortality, addressing that moment we're all going to face, but to do so by creating art which lives forever. So that was potent stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been telling friends it's sort of portrait of the artist as an older man, being able to look at him that way.
That's right.
Well, Alex, it's a magnificent film. I might be overstating, but it gets you choked up watching it, and it's quite powerful and beautiful. So thank you for sharing and bringing us behind the scenes and the making of it. It's really beautiful, so congratulations. And the film, for those, is In Restless Dreams, the music of Paul Simon, which premieres on MGM Plus on March 17th. Alex, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene: AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
All right, Michael, that's one more documentary for the watch list.
Ashley, do you have a favorite Paul Simon song?
Yeah, of course, Michael, The Boxer.
Ah.
What does that say about me? What did the tea leaves read there? What's yours?
I don't know. I don't think you've squandered your resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, so that's all I'd say.
Good to know. Okay, well, on that note, besides listening to Bridge Over Troubled Water, Michael, do you have anything at all you can recommend to us this weekend?
So the Oscars just ended, Ashley. Have you happened to see Poor Things, which stars Emma Stone and which she won the Academy Award for?
Wouldn't miss it. I'm loving the conversations now around that movie. Like, was it a feminist masterpiece or was it completely retrograde?
Yeah, for those of you who haven't seen it. It's been described as many things, or a sort of modern day retelling of a Frankenstein monster or something. But I thought she was fantastic in it. Willem Dafoe is great. Mark Ruffalo. And how do you read it? Do you read it as a parable for something?
I didn't take it quite as seriously as some of the critics did. I mean, I just sort of looked at it as a piece of filmmaking versus a treatise on the state of women in our society.
Right. Well, I'm only laughing because, like, I met it as a piece of entertainment.
But Mark Ruffalo is incredible in it, too. I mean, congratulations to Emma Stone. Clearly very deserved. I thought his performance in many ways was just as memorable.
Yeah, he's great in everything. Always is. And you, my dear, do you have anything to recommend this week?
I'm embarrassed to say, Michael, that I've been watching the new Guy Ritchie show on Netflix, The Gentlemen. That's just the kind of week I've been having.
Is it as great as the reviews have been leading me to believe?
I think it's kind of fun. I mean, it's sort of right up our alley. It's a story about an aristocratic guy named Eddie who inherits his family estate. And it turns out, oops, it's the home of an enormous marijuana empire. And the current inhabitants are squatting in the house. So that's sort of the premise. But it's really fun. And it's a bit of escapism, which we all need, especially in this moment of the news cycle. Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We wish you a fabulous weekend full of lots of escapism and fun. Michael, will you please read us out?
Thank you. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan, and our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of Airmail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Airmail Weekly, but we will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thank you again for joining us.